And welcome back to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. I'm Steve Zwemke in for Lori Walsh today. South Dakota has had only one American Indian congressman, Benjamin Rifle. Sean Flynn is a history professor at Dakota Wesleyan University in Mitchell. His new book is called Without Reservation, Benjamin Rifle and American Indian Acculturation. It looks at the inspiring and controversial life and ideology of Ben Rifle and elicits impassioned responses from readers. A book signing and presentation is scheduled for 11:30 Friday morning at the Tiger Cafe inside the McGovern Library on the DWU campus. The event is free and open to the public. And right now, Dr. Flynn joins us on by phone from Dakota Wesleyan University in Mitchell. Dr. Flynn, welcome to the program.
It's great to be on again, Steve.
It's nice to have you with us, especially with this book out now. First of all, tell me about your interest in Ben Rifle, how you became interested in Ben as a topic for a book.
Well, back in 2012, John Miller, John Lauck, and Donald Simmons were inviting submissions for a new series of essays for their second volume of South Dakota Political Culture. And I thought I would contribute an essay on the history of Native American politics, but done in a way that might be a more fresher approach, a less stale approach, something that hadn't been tread over a lot in terms of the topic. It occurred to me that no full-length biography had been written about our lone American Indian congressman. So I contributed to that volume by writing about Ben's congressional career. But in the process of collecting data and interpreting that data about his congressional career, which was relatively brief, he served a decade in the United States House of Representatives from 1961 to 1971. But in collecting historical data on that, I was introduced to a very controversial figure. And the title of the book, Without Reservation, the reason I chose that title is because Ben envisioned a world without reservations. He wanted American Indian people to imagine living in a world where there were no poverty-oppressed reservations that were that characterized life in South Dakota. Additionally, that title, Without Reservation, refers to the fact that he had no regrets about taking these controversial positions, that he had lived Indian life from the inside. He had spent the first 22 years of his life on a reservation. He was well-versed in his language. He was bilingual. He understood his culture well. He understood his heritage and was ferociously proud of his Lakota heritage and ferociously proud of the history of the Lakota people. He'd also lived American Indian life from the inside in a 22-year career with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And a lot of that time had been spent in South Dakota on the Pine Ridge Reservation and the Rosebud Sioux Reservation and in North Dakota on the Fort Berthold Reservation. And I thought, you know, this controversial figure who has these alternative ways of viewing the future of American Indian life, his story should be told and his voice should be heard, if nothing more, to start a conversation about the modernization of American Indian life. And this is a gentleman who had the street cred, so to speak, and the legitimacy, so to speak, to be able to share his controversial views. And no one could denounce him for not being an American Indian and being an outsider. He was a firsthand observer of Indian life, and that legitimized his point of view and makes his controversial points of view something we must listen to and we must consider.
You touched on how he embraced the day, his work ethic. Was Ben Rifle a leader from an early age? I mean, as a person growing up and going through school, was he a leader?
That's a great question. Not really. You know, he didn't speak any English until he went to elementary school. So here's this young 5-year-old, 6-year-old entering elementary school who is very much in line and versed in his mother's way of life. His mother was Lakota. His father, William, was German-American. And his grandmother on his mother's side lived with him as well. So this is someone who's raised in a traditional home and a traditional environment. But what educators on the Rosebud Sioux Reservation recognized was he was extremely bright, and for his age, very articulate. And at age 19, he seems destined just to remain on the reservation. He would be a farmer rancher working alongside his father, who was a farmer rancher in Todd County. And it kind of looked like this is what Ben was going to do for the rest of his life. But some officials, BIA officials and educators on the reservation, approached his parents and said, "You know, there's this high school in Brookings. It's a seasonal school where farm boys can go from October to March. Your son only has an eighth grade diploma, but we think he's gifted. We think he's intellectually talented, and at least let him finish high school." So he gets on a train. For the first time in his life, he leaves the reservation and goes out into the white man's world. And a miracle takes place. I don't know a better way to describe it. He leaves with this message from his father, this formula from his father, who told his son, "Be on time and accept the fact that your life in the white man's world will be ruled by the clock, and that white men are future minded. So be mindful of that. Work hard. Adopt what today we might call the Protestant work ethic. Make sure you demonstrate to your employers that you're a hard worker, and to your teachers that you're a hard worker. And save your money. You know, there is no giveaway mentality in the white man's world, and the nuclear family is what's most important in the white man world." And he says, if you do these things, you'll succeed. So here's this young 19-year-old who whips through high school in 3 years, applies for admission to South Dakota State College, is admitted in 1928, which was very rare. American Indians in college at that time were attending Carlisle Indian School or Haskell College or other Indian schools across the country, and it would have been very, very rare for a young Indian man to be at a land-grant institution or a flagship institution, a public university in the United States. But he's admitted, and now it's at this moment that his leadership skills shine. He joins ROTC. He's commissioned as a second lieutenant upon graduation, and he would rise to the rank of lieutenant colonel before his career was over. He earns two scholarships, dairy science and chemistry scholarships. He is voted his junior year the student body president. Now, just I ask your listeners to take a moment and think about that. This young Indian man on a college campus, it's an ag school in which there's just no Indian people. He's the student body president. He's voted the most representative senior. He leads the Hobo Day parade. He was transformed in this college life, where he realized that there's no mystery to the white man's world. There's nothing mysterious about it. If you follow the rules of the game, so to speak, that you can retain your Indian personality and your Indian heritage, even your language, and still succeed by straddling two cultures, still succeed in the white man's world and achieve everything you want in terms of material well-being and intellectual satisfaction in that world. And that experience at SDSC was the pivotal moment in Ben's life.
That's a great answer to what was a pretty simple question. tell me about his legacy with the BIA.
Yeah, he joined the BIA at a revolutionary moment in Indian affairs. Franklin Roosevelt had just been elected president. And for Commissioner of Indian Affairs, he selected John Collier, who wanted to turn the governing bodies of Indian reservations back to the American Indians themselves, let them hold their own elections, let them choose their tribal councils, let them write their own constitutions, incorporate themselves, and rule themselves and determine their own fate. Additionally, the Collier era ended the allotment policy, and it secured the Indian land base. And it created this confidence of among American Indians that they were now in control or had some agency over affairs on their reservation. Well, that's Ben arrives right when this is going on, and he is the pivotal individual in the writing, in the crafting of the Oglala Sioux Constitution and the Rosebud Sioux Constitution. His fingerprints are all over those constitutions. Mm. And what's remarkable is many of the leaders of those two communities were much more comfortable speaking and listening to Lakota language. Well, here's this young civil servant from the Bureau of Indian Affairs who can walk into a meeting and explain the most complicated, complex political concept or political theory in their own language. And it's remarkable how better versed and how much more his audience has comprehended a Euro-American instruments like constitutions better than communities of other tribes who did not have that bilingual advantage. So he's pivotal in instituting what's called the Indian New Deal. And the central piece of the Indian New Deal, which is the Indian Reorganization Act, which empowers the tribes to rule themselves. And it makes him a rising star. John Collier knows who Ben Riefel is, and it secures his ascendancy in the BIA. From that point forward, he will be groomed for some of the top positions in the BIA, and eventually in 1976, President Gerald Ford will name him the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. So it's when he arrived and how effective he was at introducing American Indians to this new way of thinking about politics that makes him so valuable in the history of the BIA.
Sean Flynn, Professor Sean Flynn from Dakota Wesleyan University, is our guest. His book is Without Reservation, Benjamin Riefel and American Indian Acculturation. As we continue to talk about his legacy, what about his legacy here in state politics in South Dakota?
Well, he was never involved in state politics per se, other than being a liaison between the Pine Ridge Sioux when he was superintendent there and the state of South Dakota, mm-hmm. or when he was the superintendent or the director, if you will, of BIA operations in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska. But in terms of his congressional career, it's one of the great chapters of South Dakota political history. It's 1960. He has this capstone position in the BIA where he's the director of the Aberdeen Area Office. The next step is Commissioner of Bureau of Indian Affairs. I mean, he's one step away from the apex of civil service leadership in the BIA. He's approached in early 1960 by some Brown County Republicans, and they don't know what party he is. If you're a civil servant in the United States, your life is controlled by the Hatch Act, and the Hatch Act makes it clear you can't publicly show a preference for either political party. But they approach him and take a risk. Ben, will you run for this vacant seat that George McGovern has left vacant because he wants to challenge Carl Mundt for the U.S. Senate? Would you consider running in the Republican primary to fill that seat? And he hems and haws for a while, speaks to his family, and eventually says, sure, why not? And he goes for it. And the campaign of 1960, which is a colorful, interesting campaign, and his opponent would be Ray Fitzgerald. And it's an interesting campaign because Ben has to sell himself in a district, the first district of South Dakota, East River, South Dakota, as someone who is knowledgeable about agriculture and knows agriculture, knows rural economies, knows what those voters in those small towns and cities like Sioux Falls want from a representative. And he wows his audiences with his knowledge and his grasp on agricultural affairs. He had firsthand experience in agriculture. He had been an agricultural extension agent, and he had thought deeply about necessary reforms in agriculture policy. And he really sold himself as someone who, if he went to Washington, D.C., if elected, could serve both the economic interests of white first district constituents and those 4,400 or so American Indians in the first district. And the voters were very impressed with he was an articulate person. He was an excellent public speaker, and he could articulate very complicated and complex economic and agriculture problems in a way that they were impressed with. And the result was they elected him, and he remains our only American Indian elected by South Dakota voters and sent to the U.S. Congress.
Professor Flynn, in South Dakota right now, are there things that South Dakotans are still benefiting from as a result of Ben Riefel's time in Congress?
I can think of two right off the top of my head, and maybe even more, but I'll start with two. I think the two pieces of legislation that he was most proud of were the pieces of legislation that funded the building of the Sisseton High School and the Sisseton School District, buildings in the Sisseton School District, and the Todd County High School. Ben was a big proponent of integrated education. And he wanted American Indian students rubbing shoulders in the classroom and out of the classroom with non-Indian students. And from his seat on the House Appropriations Committee, he was able to convince congressmen of the need for these two high schools, which weren't really high on the list of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. There were other states and other Indian communities they thought these schools should go in. But, you know, he used his influence and his connections with colleagues on the House Appropriation Committees and working across the aisle with Republicans and Democrats. And he had a lot of really good friends on the other side of the aisle, even though he was a Republican. He was able to get appropriations for those two high schools. So I think those are part of the permanent achievement of his career as a legislator, those two high schools. He worked really hard to introduce a sugar beet industry in South Dakota, and that was his greatest, most bitter political loss. Ben, during the campaign, during the 1960 campaign, he was spoke a lot on the campaign trail about the possibility of sugar beet production in the James River Valley, because there were already sugar beet mills around the Belle Fourche area. And Ben thought he could use his position on the House Agriculture Committee and later on the Appropriations Committee to expand sugar beet production in South Dakota to a point where a factory would be built, a sugar beet factory that would support not only South Dakota, but northern Nebraska, southeastern Iowa. Well, that failed, and that was a tough loss for him. But he was constantly worried about surpluses of wheat, corn, and feed grains, and the way that they depressed prices. And the 50s and 60s were not a healthy time in the agricultural economy. And Ben was looking for alternatives to these surplus crops, and he saw sugar beets as a way out of that. Even though he failed in that, I think his constituents really enjoyed or really appreciated how he fought so hard for it. And how he stood up to the Department of Agriculture and to the Kennedy and later the Johnson administration, trying to win that sugar beet production quota that would allow South Dakota to enter into the sugar beet industry. But also, I have to mention, in terms of legacy, in terms of his congressional legacy, he was a huge supporter of the National Endowment of the Humanities and the National Endowment of the Arts. And if you go to the South Dakota Art Museum on the campus of South Dakota State University, he was a key critical member of the creation of that museum and the American Indian exhibits and the American Indian collection. At that museum started because Ben donated his American Indian collection to them. So he was a big promoter of that as well. But I would say those are two important areas: education and his efforts to enhance the health of the agricultural economy in the state. I think he left a mark.
Yeah, it sounds like he was a great communicator too. As an orator, how about his floor speeches? Do you have any idea what those were like?
Yes, he had a really long floor. His longest floor speech of his congressional career was in 1965. When he was talking about the appropriations for the BIA budget for the coming fiscal year, and he explained to his colleagues, the vast majority of them who had never been on reservations, the great challenges and trials and tribulations of Indian life. And for a long time, he mesmerized his audience with this grasp on the Indian affairs and on day-to-day living on reservations, and impressed upon them the importance of federal funding for health, education, counseling services, things of that nature. And he warned his colleagues that the pace of change on Indian reservations can be snail-like. It's not, you know, things aren't going to change overnight. And he asked them to be patient, but continue to funding these needed resources and these needed institutions, these necessary institutions on the reservation. At the same time, he told his colleagues, I will do everything I can to shepherd Indian residents into the mainstream. I will do everything I can to impart to them the importance of acculturating themselves and integrating themselves into the fabric of society and encouraging them to relocate off reservations. Ben he often said that reservation boundaries were psychologically confining, and they trapped American Indians like Berlin walls in this kind of consciousness that was a 19th century frame of mind and a 19th century consciousness. And he promised his colleagues that he would help modernize reservations and do what he could to encourage reservation residents to step beyond reservation boundaries, step into white communities, straddle two cultures and accept those aspects of mainstream society and those institutions and traditions and values and institutions of mainstream society that are important in order to raise a family and maintain an adequate quality of life. And at the same time, you can retain your Indian identity and your Indian personality. So he asked Congress to be patient. He said, we need to continue to fund these programs, but I'll do my part, he said, to modernize. And when the speech was over, he was lauded by his congressional colleagues, who called it, in their time in Congress, the best speech they heard on Indian affairs.
A question I have is, with the success he had in his life, moving all the way up through the BIA into Congress, and just the successes he had in college and all of that, why was there resentment among a large population of the American Indian community toward Ben Riefle?
You know, the activists or radicals or militants, however we choose to categorize them, who made up the Red Power movement of the 1960s and 70s, including the American Indian movement, their political ideology was a separatist ideology. They wanted to retreat from mainstream America, disengage from mainstream America. It was a cultural nationalist point of view. And these militants repudiated middle-class values, the same middle-class values that Ben was asking American Indians to embrace. They repudiated European-American political institutions, the same political institutions and instruments of government that Ben was asking American Indians to embrace. They wanted to return, and they were calling for a return to more communitarian-style economies on reservations, where Ben was saying, you know, in the white man's world, the free market economy, free enterprise, and individual initiative are the pillars of democracy. They're critical to the functioning of a democracy. So I think he represented in the minds of these new Indians, capital N, capital I, that was a term that was applied to them, and the Red Power movement. He represented everything that was opposed to their ideological point of view. And that, because of that, and he said this several times during interviews and for various newspapers, because of his mainstream views and his acceptance and embracing of middle class values, he was referred to as an Apple Indian, red on the outside, white on the inside. Mm-hmm. And that wounded him. That really hurt him, because he felt like he had maintained his values and his traditions and his heritage and his language, and he had done everything he could to demonstrate that one could live in two separate worlds, and it embittered him. And he at one point said, I will probably be forgotten as an American Indian leader. I will not be seen as a role model. He specifically referred to the fact that he'll probably never be seen as a role model, because the conversation on Indian reservations seems to have changed. And there seems to be this reversion back to traditional values and traditional customs and traditional institutions, when here is Ben saying we need to move beyond that if we're going to survive as a people.
Yeah. I have so many more questions, but we only have about 30 more seconds, so I'll ask one final question. Could Ben Riefle get elected today?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think he was a very humble man, and people who knew him, and I've in the course of writing this book, I've got to meet a lot of people who knew Ben, and they said he was such a humble, genuine, sincere person. And I think we're hungry for that kind of political leadership. And his knowledge of agriculture and agricultural affairs and his understanding of Indian affairs, I think, would make him an extremely attractive candidate in 2018 in South Dakota.